Extra time.
Hello and welcome back to the Extra Time podcast. It's been a long, unplanned hiatus for us. Yeah, I don't know, man. Like, I'm sorry about this. If you've been waiting to see the podcast in your feeds, then you've been disappointed every week. But to be honest, sun's out. Go and enjoy yourself. Get outside. One person not outside enjoying himself today is Henry Hill, who returns to the podcast. Podcast all-star Henry Hill. How are you doing, Henners?
I'm very well, thank you, Pat. I agree, just to echo your sentiment. I am sorry to everyone. I feel as if this has been one of the most requested things I've seen in the comments, on my Twitter feeds, whatnot. So I can only apologise. But yes, we thought we'd give you a little treat, Pat and I, back on the pod again. You're right. I wish I was outside rather than filming this. But what can you do? Pat, how are you? You're right?
I'm all good, man. It's good to be on a podcast, you know, with no dross, no filler. Ooh. It's just all lethal football content. Yeah, I don't know. It is nice to be back because it does give us an opportunity to talk about some other stuff, I think, the podcast. Things that would not normally get a bit of shine on the channel. So today we're going to do a little bit of a news roundup, and then we're going to talk about some of our hopes for next season and our predictions. So the things that we would like to happen and the things we think will actually happen. I haven't seen Henry's list. Henry might have seen mine, but we'll see what goes on there. But first, there are a few little stories that we're going to run through. Henry, I know that you were saying that maybe we should kick off with my feelings about Arsenal and the top four, given that we're recording this the Tuesday morning after Arsenal lost away to Newcastle.
Absolutely. I think it'd be rude not to kick off with a bang, you know. It's just like an opening James Bond sequence, all the fun things happening before they we delve into the rest of it. So Pat, I mean, that was a capitulation against Newcastle. That's probably one of the most dominant performances I've seen this season, which really added sort of insult to injury. Callum Wilson playing off his skin. I mean, it was quite a wild. I mean, we'll get onto Newcastle maybe a bit later, but yeah, exciting times for the tune. But yeah, surely, Pat, this was huge. This was huge. This basically dictated a lot of the transfer targets you were going to get this summer, because it's that funny one where you've just got to nab them at the time you've got Champions League football, then sort of keep them around. So yeah, this really is going to throw off a bit of the development. I'm still quite optimistic about Arsenal. I think the youth in that squad, I really think it's a 2-3 year project. But 13 losses this season, it is damning. And you're throwing the door open to Tottenham, who haven't had to do a whole lot to get Champions League this year. I mean, what was your take on that match? Because surely that is quite a devastating moment for you.
I mean, it was a really bad performance, but actually it was like the only really bad performance we've had for a while. I mean, well, okay, the Spurs one, but you go down a man within 20 minutes or whatever, I'm kind of like, that's a write-off. Like, what are you going to do in that situation? In this one, I thought, I mean, yeah, they just pressed us off the pitch. And I think part of that is tiredness. This is a really thin squad. So in a way, the failure to me, people are talking about like tactics, as if the tactics went wrong here. I'd say that actually, if there was a failing of Arteta's that led to that game, it was the way that they gutted the squad in January without bringing in any reinforcements. That to me is what led to that happening, right? Because Arsenal lost Tierney, they lost Partey, they couldn't rotate at all down the stretch. They're in a position where one centre-back gets injured, another gets a red card, and suddenly you're wondering how they're even going to put out a back line for a game. That's not a position that a club as rich as Arsenal should really be in. That said, at the beginning of the season, I didn't expect us to be anywhere near the Champions League. I really didn't think so. You know, Man United obviously finished in the top four last season and strengthened, or at least we thought they did. You know, Chelsea and the other two just looked like they were completely out of our grasp. So in a way, it's good that we were able to get to this point with a very thin, very young squad. So from that point of view, when I look at it in the broader sense, it doesn't bother me too much. I guess, yeah, I just think everyone looked gassed. Everyone looked exhausted. Yeah. And Arteta started making substitutions to try and get a goal. And I understand that. But what those substitutions didn't do is give us a way to get the ball back in this game. And I don't know. I just think it was a bit of a confluence of circumstances. I think that if Arsenal had, say, lost the Chelsea game and then won this one, you know, then it might have even looked a bit better, even if the consequence would have been the same, that Arsenal had finished fifth. It would have felt less like a bottling, or less like a, you know, a bunch of mistakes. But I don't know, I am still pretty optimistic about Arsenal. We're going to talk a little bit about Arsenal later, but this is a team that is starting to play football the right way again. Like, when we talk about those losses, a lot of those losses came before mid-December, which was when Aubameyang got benched, Martinelli came into the side. And if you look at Arsenal, before December, a pretty bad side. I mean, like, genuinely about a league average side. Since December, comfortably one of the five best teams in the country, and vastly dominant in the majority of their games. You know, even if you look at some of the games we've lost down the stretch, the Palace game by XG, very close, definitely had some chances in that match. The Brighton game, we were the better side. Southampton game, we were the better side. We should have won those matches. So it's really only been these last two that have been like really classic bad Arsenal performances.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, you know what? Like, my side is in the Premier League. It's an exciting team. It's got a bright future. These are things that I don't feel like I should take for granted. And I'm at least invested in the side again, you know? The last couple of years, I was like, who gives a shit? We are maybe the most boring side to watch in the league. There's nothing really to hold on to except the fact that there are a couple of youngsters coming in who look like they may be good. Well, now those youngsters are actually good. And I do think that probably get a striker in, get a midfielder in, and add some depth pieces, which actually you can do whether you're in the Champions League or not. And suddenly this starts to look like a pretty solid side. And on the other hand, I look at Spurs and I think, are Spurs better than us right now? Yeah, probably. But I don't think Conte's there long term. Son is going to be 30 in a couple of months. Kane is going to be 29 in a couple of months. I still feel like there's work that needs to be done there. At least Arsenal have had all that pain and are now kind of on the upswing a little bit, it feels. So I don't really understand all the Arteta out stuff that's going on at the moment.
Yeah, like, nonsense.
Like, wanting Arteta out like a year ago when we were playing horrific football, we were incredibly boring. It looked like there were no tactical ideas. And Arteta seemed to be making it worse, not better, by his decisions. That I understand. I felt that way. Wanting him out now? I don't know. Like, sure, if you think somebody else better is on the market, I get it. But, like, I don't know. I kind of feel like the team has progressed this season. And Arteta, we kind of made the same gamble with Arteta that we made with the young players, right? You say, we believe in their talent enough that we accept the fact that there are going to be speed bumps along the way. And at least this speed bump feels so big and so painful because we were going really fast when we hit it. It could have just been a season where we limped to eighth again, and that is what I expected back in November. So from that point of view, I'm considering myself lucky.
You know what? I thought that's quite measured of you, Pat. Quite a positive response. Yeah, I mean, the Europa League, I really don't think it's a bad place to be. I think as a competition this year, it's really strengthened. I think the introduction of the Conference League has massively helped that. And actually, Arsenal weren't going to... You're maybe going to get through to the knockout rounds of the Champions League, but no further, realistically speaking.
Yeah,
I know
exactly.
There's the nostalgia of it, but you're not going to beat one of the big boys in Europe at the moment. I firmly believe that. So I think Europa League, if they take it seriously as a competition, you could have a real crack at and probably do quite well in. So I think that's actually hugely exciting right now. And yeah, like you say, it's a real work in progress. I just will be intrigued to see after that World Cup. We saw George Wright on Twitter, our other resident Arsenal fan, maybe touting the idea of Luis Enrique, the Spanish coach. I just wonder if things aren't quite going to plan and if the losses are racking up for Arteta next season. Because, I mean, you're just a few signings away from a really quality squad. Most people know you are. I mean, they need a centre forward for a starter. I think if someone like Luis Enrique becomes available in January, I mean, Pat, is that something that interests you? Or do you think, I know Arteta was recently handed a new long contract, is that just a case now of sticking with this journey and letting it play out? Or if there is an opportunity to change, do you go for it?
I wouldn't change, or at least not for Luis Enrique. I think that this is... It really depends what happens. Like, I think there's no reason to assume that Arsenal are going to have a big regression next season. It looks like they're kind of going to continue to get better. And we've got to bear in mind people like Saka. Saka's 20. You know, there is more to come from these players. Now, that doesn't mean that it's going to come every season. They're just going to get better and better. Quite often, players have a bit of a ragged line of progress. But, Saliba's going to come back, it looks like. That's an amazing addition to Arsenal's backline. Yeah, and it's really not a player they have to convince to come in, which is quite a good situation. But look, I was going to say this later, but let's bear in mind that Arsenal signed Lacazette, Aubameyang, Thomas Partey, Nicolas Pepe, Ben White, Kieran Tierney, Martin Odegaard. They signed all those players without Champions League football. So it's not like it's impossible to get players who are good enough to play the Champions League when you're not in the Champions League, right? You can do it. The question will be what Arsenal do striker-wise. That's going to be the big position to fill. But yeah, I don't know. I think that if a manager became available like a Tuchel type, then I would potentially see the argument for changing. Luis Enrique, I like him. And he's a good problem solver, but that's not the position Arsenal's squad are in. Arsenal's squad are not like a bunch of mismatched parts that you need somebody to figure out how to put it together. They're a team that needs to be kind of nurtured through into adulthood, really. Is that something Luis Enrique has done? I don't think it is before. So, I think actually the managerial market, in my view, is a little bit thin right now. So I would happily stick with Arteta. And you know what? If Arsenal have a bad season next year, and I don't mean like four great sides beat them to the top four, I mean like they look like they've taken a step back and they look like they're not progressing, then we can talk about it. But at the moment, this is a good team, and a couple of bad performances don't change that. And I also think this whole narrative about like, God, how bad is the top four race this season? All these teams are terrible. I think that's bullshit, and I think it's being pushed by salty Man United fans and people who just kind of like don't really understand the way that the league as a whole has got better. Like Newcastle went out in January and bought a Champions League quality central midfielder and they're not the only ones to do something like that. Like you see teams do this all the time where they pick up players. You know, Brighton have a midfielder who's been linked to all the top sides. That's a sign of good recruitment. Spurs are going to get top four with probably 70, 71 points. That's top four quality in basically any season, and it's in a tougher league. So I don't agree with this idea that like the league's really weak and the top four contenders are really weak. I don't think they are at all. I think that actually Spurs now are a good side and Arsenal are a good side. I think the top three are all good sides, obviously. And I think next year the chances are Man United will be good. The chances are Villa will be better. I think Leicester might rebound a bit. You know, there's lots to come from this league generally.
No, I absolutely agree. I do. Although I do think that you are primed to have a good turn at the Champions League next year. I'm not sure. I'm not unconvinced United are going to be in a much greater state, unless they have doing massive overhauls to their squad. But yeah, that actually is something I wanted to talk about later in one of my predictions for next season. So we'll park that for now. How about we move on to the rest of the news for the week? So I think we can't really overlook the incredible news that Jake Daniels, he's come out to become the UK's first active gay male professional football player. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, I watched his interview. I actually thought that Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher summed it up perfectly on Monday Night Football. Was it just how well spoken he was, how sort of mature and level headed? I mean, I'm absolutely thrilled for him. I mean, he said, since I've come out to my family, my club and my teammates, that period of overthinking everything and the stress it created has gone. It was impacting my mental health. Now I'm just confident and happy to be myself, finally. I've been thinking for a long time about how I wanted to do it, when I want to do it. I know now is the time. I'm ready to be myself, be free, be confident with it all. I think it is excellent. And yeah, it's a really great step forward for football. I really hope so. I mean, the fact that he's done it at 17 as well, not at the end of his career, not when he's retired. He's done it at a moment where he's got everything to come. He's just made his first team debut in May. I think this is a really huge moment. And, you know, credit to Blackpool as well. But let's be under no illusion. I mean, I don't go to a load of live games, but I went to one this year. I won't name two teams, but I sat next to the way end. The amount of homophobic abuse that was levelled us on an FA Cup day, I should add, where it was like family day. There were loads of parents of their children who left at half time because they couldn't quite believe it. I'm not going to say which the team was. But I was shocked. I'd almost forgotten about it because you do kind of live in a bubble sometimes, just thinking, oh no, it's, you occasionally see it, but you know, football's being progressive, football's working towards solutions and stuff like that. I mean, you've got written here, it's pretty embarrassing that football is still in this spot in 2022, and you're absolutely right, it is. And yeah, that live game really like reaffirmed to me just how difficult and tough it must be to make a decision like Jake Daniels has done. But it is, Pat, it is, to come out of nowhere like this, it is great. And I think it is optimistic at a time which I think we need a bit of optimism.
Yeah, and I think what I really like about this is that I think that lots of places in the world are, you know, governed by norms, right? Like, and I think like the UK, especially like the UK, because it has this sense of like things have been done this way forever, it's often really slow to change. It's a very conservative place. And football is the most conservative part of it in some ways, yeah. You know, like football has just, if you advocate for any sort of change in football, it's unbelievably difficult to get any traction. And so one of the things I like about this, I thought, when I read it, I thought, Jesus, he's 17 and he's doing this. And then I thought, no, of course he's 17. Because actually, I find when I talk to people who are a generation younger than me, they kind of think the way things have been done is stupid. And yeah, and I feel like they're much more willing to just ignore kind of norms and say, no, this is how I think things should work. You know, I know that pisses off our parents' generation because they think, oh, these kids, they think that their mental health matters more than work or something. But actually, they do, and that's a good thing. And in this situation, it feels like Jake Daniels has said, being honest about who I am as a person is like the most natural thing in the world. Because now, if you go to school, obviously, like, you're going to tell your friends you're gay. Like, he seems to have recognized that being truthful about who he is far more important than making sure that some old people in football or some homophobic people in the dressing room feel comfortable. Actually, feeling comfortable is the enemy of progress. Like, you don't need people to feel comfortable all the time. That's not always a good thing. And so I hope that this really does challenge people to take a look at themselves. And I hope it challenges people to call out homophobia when they see it, because generally speaking in football, a lot of the people who claim that they are, you know, big advocates for progress in the game don't actually do very much at all. They don't do very much at all. They said Black Lives Matter when it became politically expedient for them to say Black Lives Matter. They talk about homophobia and mental health and stuff in this kind of like loose throwaway kind of way where it doesn't really matter very much to them. But they don't actually take a look at themselves and they don't actually say things which would maybe make life a little bit difficult for them. And I think if you're not an ally when things are difficult, then you're not an ally. So I really hope that this means that we start to see more people come out and we start to see people say the way the game has been is not good enough. Because, you know, if, say, 5 to 10% of people are gay or bisexual, then that means there are kind of 15 to 30 Premier League players who are probably gay or bisexual. It would be weird if there weren't.
Yes, I agree.
So, in fact, if there weren't, what that would suggest to me is that gay and bisexual men think that they can't go into football because it's not a safe place for them. And that would be a really depressing feeling for them to have, though understandable. So I really hope that this starts to change things because, frankly, like, these are the things that kind of start to sicken your stomach and turn you against the game a little bit. You know, what you've talked about there, like going to a match, the idea of going to a match, like with your kid and then having to leave because of the things you're hearing is so horrifying that you think you're going to have a nice day out, you know, with your friends or your kid or your dad or whoever it might be. And you have to leave because it's such a toxic atmosphere. That is so demoralizing. And it's the absolute opposite of what the sport is meant to be. So yeah. Good on Jake Daniels. Yeah. Good on Jake Daniels. Finally, somebody has the balls to do something that I think a lot of people in football would not.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you just really hope soon it gets to a point where you don't need a big press conference to make this kind of statement, this whole kind of coming out process. I mean, Jake Daniels, he hasn't had much of a senior career so far, but for now, he's going to be known as the man that broke the taboo, and great for him. But I'm sure deep down, he just wants to be known as a great footballer, and that is, I guess, the ultimate progression. Where, you know, if someone's gay, it doesn't necessarily, well, means absolutely nothing within football conversations. So yeah, I echo that completely. Super thrilled for Jake Daniel, and I really hope that the rest of the football community does get behind, doesn't just say they are, like we've all seen on Twitter, but does get behind him and does everything it can to stamp out any kind of incidences that might make anyone who's thinking about coming out feel uncomfortable within a football's situation. But as we've seen, that's easier said than done. But yes, it is progress so far. Not only that, there's another bit of progress this week. This is something that I was sent on Twitter. This is that Wolves have partnered with Football for Future. So a lot to do with like climate change. And I think Wolves are trying to become the first kind of carbon neutral club in the Premier League. We've obviously seen Forest Green get tons of traction for what they're kind of trying to do. I think Tottenham's new stadium has made a big point about being carbon neutral, and they've had a lot of sort of eco-friendly days this year. But yeah, it's quite exciting for Wolves, prompted by fans who passed a motion in 2021 demanding greater sustainability for the club to move towards net zero carbon emissions. And yeah, it is quite harrowing actually when you do see some of like the statistics about this. So a quarter of professional clubs in England could be flooded on a regular basis by 2050. That includes Stamford Bridge, the London Stadium, St Mary's, you know, Hull, Cardiff, etc. And you know, we've already seen, I mean, I certainly know from playing grassroots football how often pitches are absolutely torn and shredded up every week. We saw the women's football final at the Tokyo Olympics had to be delayed due to extreme heat, etc. So yeah, this is another issue as well, and it's good to see Wolves taking that head on. I mean, I'm sure you could agree with me in that sense. It's this Football for Future, which is a brand new charity which has been started to try and really push this through the sport, and I think that's pretty positive as well.
Yeah, same. And it does, it's nice that it's kind of fans pushing these things, and that hopefully that will kind of raise awareness, because with football you have such an enormous captive audience that it seems it becomes kind of negligent to not try and do something good with it.
Quickly, did you see that fan who's to get to the playoff final at Wembley from, I think it's from Sunderland, he's flying to Spain than flying to London because it's cheaper. It's to get a train or a bus down to Wembley from Sunderland. Apparently he's flying to Spain, which isn't really the point. I mean, it's a little Daily Mail article.
Well, it is a little bit though, right? Because, you know, these conversations about fans not being able to get to football matches because trains aren't running or because trains are so expensive, it does now mean that you're having conversations about why trains are so expensive and how we need to have, you know, more sustainable, more affordable transport in the country. So it is interesting how these conversations can actually start in football and then filter out into the mainstream, because it affects a lot of people.
That decision to host the Liverpool, was it City semi-final at Wembley or something like that, when they were begging it to be at Old Trafford, I think that's another classic example of football just not getting it from time to time.
Yeah, but it's like steering the Titanic, isn't it? It's like you throw the engines into reverse and then it's like the length of a couple of football fields before it actually comes to a stop, and then you've still got to go backwards. So, I mean, that's kind of how it feels with football. But should we move on then to the future of football? Should we talk a little bit about our hopes and predictions for next season? Because, I don't know, I'm quite intrigued to see what you've got here. And to be honest, we've already been talking for quite a long time, Henry. So we need to snap into these, man.
Right.
What have you got? Should we start with one of your hopes? You do a hope and a prediction, then I'll do a hope and a prediction. We'll do it that way.
Right. My hope, it's kind of similar to what you've gone for here. My hope is that Roma are challenging for Serie A next season. Okay. I love Jose Mourinho. I love what he's done there. I think it's really positive. I love Tammy Abraham to bits. I just think they're a club going in the right direction at the moment. Serie A is so exciting at the moment. You know, he said they've like sacrificed points this year for the Conference League, which is fair enough. But although their last five results have been pretty abysmal, I think they drew at the weekend against Venezia, who are probably the worst team in the league, bar none. Probably the worst team I've seen on TV this year, actually, Venezia. And yeah, so that's not good enough. But yeah, I just think with a few maybe sound additions, there's talk of Dybala going there now, which doesn't really make much sense in my mind. But I want things to work out so bad for Jose Mourinho. I love the kind of footage that's come out from his time there. It seems like a perfect match. And I really think that, although I think AC Milan are going to be a great force next year, I think Inter pretty much going to continue on their vein. I think there is an opening for them to go for third, to go for at least try and push them all the way, because I'm not sure Napoli are going to be able to go again next year in the way that we saw them do this year. Certainly if they lose a lot of personnel, they're losing Dries Mertens, they're probably going to lose Koulibaly. These are big names in the dressing room. They're losing Insigne as well. I think it's going to be very difficult for them to maintain with the Milan clubs. Juventus, I probably think, will have another crack at it next year with a few sort of smart additions in the market. However, I just really want Roma to go for it. I really want it to happen. What do you think about that? I don't think you're a Mourinho fan, if I remember correctly.
I'm not a Mourinho fan. I don't really see it happening, to be honest, because I think Inter are better, I think Milan are better, and Milan are younger. So there's a lot more to come from the players they've got there, I think. Juve are obviously not going to have a quiet summer. It looks like they're going to try and bring in Pogba, and I'm sure they'll try and do some other stuff, though I don't know. Allegri back there is a bit depressing. I don't really see it happening. It's a pity, because I've always had a soft spot for Roma. You know, great club and a great city, kind of perennial underachievers. Obviously, Francesco Totti, very easy way to fall in love with Roma, because who wouldn't fall in love with Francesco Totti? But I don't know, like, as much as I want the best for Tammy Abraham and I really like Lorenzo Pellegrini, for example, I can't really get on board with Mourinho's Roma, and I do not think that Mourinho has the sauce anymore to overcome the other managers in that league. Like, I think Roma have a weaker squad than a bunch of other squads, and I don't think Mourinho is the best manager in the league. Or at least he's not the best fit with his team in such a way that it could bridge that gap. Obviously, it remains to be seen what they do in the summer. It looks like they might go back in for Granit Xhaka, and I think that probably Mourinho would get a tune out of him. They could well do some interesting moves, but actually, the summer transfer window is kind of now the time where Mourinho ruins your club. Like, back in the day, I mean, obviously it seems like he had a lot of structure around him, but back in the day, Mourinho would blend smart signings and experienced campaigners. And as he's got older, he's gone more and more towards experienced campaigners. Tammy Abraham is actually quite an unusual signing in that regard. Though even then, you could argue that's quite a conservative choice. So I think, yeah, I don't know. I just don't want to see him load Roma up with a bunch of 28-year-olds, because that actually will hurt them in the long term. I think they need a similar kind of root and branch turnover like Milan had a few years ago. But yeah, you know what? Serie A has been shat on for years. I would much rather watch Serie A football than Ligue 1. Probably the most of the Bundesliga, with the exception of three teams. Certainly than La Liga, which is still trading on its reputation from half a decade ago and now is unbelievably dull.
It's the oldest league in Europe, in the top five leagues.
And it's so dull. But the actual football is so dull. It's really turgid. Like, the football played in La Liga these days is very similar to what football used to be in Serie A, where it's teams pressing defensively, not in an attacking way, and they're just grindy. You know, Sevilla are a grindy side. Villarreal are a grindy side. Atletico Madrid, grindy. Barcelona have been pretty grindy under Xavi. This Real Madrid side, unbelievably boring. It's just a boring team with Benzema and Vinicius bolted on top. Like, so I don't know, man. Like, I think that Serie A, it's outrageous that it still has this bad reputation, because if you want to see goals, watch Serie A. If you want to see pressing, watch Serie A. If you want to see exciting young players who are actually playing in a tough division, then watch Serie A. So I don't know. I think that should be a hope for next season, that people will start watching Italian football again.
That's class. It's on BT. I love the fact, like, Cremonese getting promoted. I feel like every year some random club I've never, ever heard of is getting promoted into Serie A just to get sort of shat back down again. But I completely agree with you. I think BT have done a great job promoting that. What's your first hope? I think it's probably a bit more realistic.
Okay, my hope is that Dortmund win the Bundesliga.
Yeah.
And look, I mean, we all hope this every year. But I do think there's a reason to kind of be relatively optimistic in some ways. I think Bayern had a really poor back half of the season. You know, in the autumn, we were talking about them as maybe the third, you know, third, fourth best team in the world. They're in that top four with the Premier League's top three. And actually, after Christmas, they became pretty shaky. And they ended up letting in over a goal a game across the whole campaign for the second year running. Now, that doesn't sound that bad, but to put it in context, before last season, they'd gone 10 years allowing under a goal a game in each Bundesliga campaign. And it's been 25 years since they had 2 years in a row where they conceded more than a goal a game. So we're in quite unusual territory right now. And I think Dortmund are in a really great phase of attracting talent. You know, they've added Niklas Süle. He's going there from Bayern, which is interesting because it's not like he's finished. He's still kind of in his prime. They got in Schlotterbeck, who was heavily linked with Bayern Munich. They're adding Adeyemi up front. And yes, of course, they're losing Erling Braut Haaland, but he missed around 40% of the minutes this season. So even if you have a striker who's like two-thirds as good as Haaland or half as good as Haaland, who's available all the time, you can argue that actually overall that's a bit of an improvement. Because maybe when Haaland comes back, you win some games you would have won 2-1, 4-1. But he's not available to you so much of the time. That's the main ability that a player can have is availability. And so I think that strengthening the attack overall will help. And actually, they've got a bunch of players who are going to continue to progress as well. So Bellingham's going to be a year older. Daniel Malen will have settled a little bit more. Giovanni Reyna will be coming back from injury. He's had a really stop-start campaign. Then they've got youngsters like Mukoko and Bino Gittens who are coming in from the academy. And there's a big question about what Bayern are going to look like next season because, of course, Lewandowski's been linked with this move away. They wanted Antonio Rudiger, apparently, and they're not going to end up with him. So I don't really know what Bayern are going to go and do this summer, how they're going to strengthen, what they're going to do to maintain this big gap. And if they lose Lewandowski, I think them losing Lewandowski is arguably a bigger problem than Dortmund losing Haaland because of that availability factor.
I completely agree. I think a lot of Bayern fans are pretty fed up with Upamecano at the moment. It looks Sabitzer wants to leave. I think you're right. There's even Gnabry, there's talks that he might be walking out the door in a few years. I think they're almost the victim of too much success. I think a lot of their players are wanting to try something else. And I agree with you about Dortmund. I actually got incredibly fed up with Dortmund this year. I think they've been trading off their kind of anti-Bayern spirit for a long time, being that, you know, the yellow and black kit, that the side that the Westfalenstadion, I think they've been very cool for a long time, but this year just got to the point where it's like, what are you doing? Why do you keep losing to these teams? Like, stop conceding goals. It really pissed me off Dortmund this year. And I'm with you. I think they clearly seem to think about it. They're going to invest some money in the market. I still think they need to get another striker in. McCubbin and I were saying someone like Seb Haller. I'd like to see them get a 26, 27-year-old striker who's scoring goals already, someone that could go in there and replace Haaland. But yes, I agree with you. I think they could genuinely challenge for the title next year. I think Bayer Leverkusen, if they can make a few solid additions, could really have a hit at the title, because I don't think they're going to lose any of their best players this season, and I think they're building towards something pretty special with the players they've got. I think, hopefully, because it needs it, and even the Bundesliga accepts it by suggesting they might have a playoff to decide the championship at the end of the regular season. They accept that it needs to be more competitive, and hopefully, as you've pointed out, this summer might be the time that we see the pendulum begin to swing a little bit, because it has been incredibly boring in German football. Actually, just while we're talking about Dortmund, my other hope, this might sound quite controversial, but it's kind of to do with a lot of the things you said. One of them was that Tomori was going to get into the England squad. That's a hope, because I think Gareth Southgate might not do it because he's a plonker. And so I really hope that. But above that, it's a bit controversial, but I really hope that Haaland is a bit of a flop in the Premier League. This was my hope, because it does annoy me that he's missed so many games of injury. Obviously, his goal-scoring record is insane. But this is a guy that really has been at the top of European football for like two seasons, if that, really, game time. And he's gone to City. He's probably commanding a wage which is greater than everyone bar maybe De Bruyne in that squad. And it is kind of annoying that they were able to buy someone for 100 million last year and go out and buy, it's not a 60 million transfer, let's be clear. It's probably something in the grand scheme of all the costs, it's going to be something far larger. It annoys me that money that's supposed to be spent on agent fees and his dad for just telling him to go to City. These things annoy me. And I just, part of me wishes that it really doesn't work out. I think it's a long shot, but I mean, what do you think? Because what you said about 40% of missing minutes this season is annoying. It is well annoying when it comes to Haaland.
Yeah, I mean, there was the part of me I considered actually as one of my hopes, like Haaland will stay fit all season, just because I would like to see how many goals he would score with this City team behind him. But I know what you're saying. Like, City can just like drop 100 mil on Jack Grealish. And don't get me wrong, I actually think Jack Grealish has been good, and I will defend this. Like, I just think people don't understand that he's not playing as a forward for Pep, even though Pep has specifically said that. But it is annoying they can do that and it just not matter. And it's annoying to me as well that for years we've seen this problem for them at left back. We've seen how thin they are in midfield, and yet they never deal with it. They just refuse to deal with it. It's so annoying. So that really infuriates me. And I would like them to just deal with those issues and be as good as they can be, or to be shit. Like, one of those two would be kind of... I'd like them either to be the best team of all time, or for it to all implode and for their smugness to be kind of shown for what it is. Because just going into a season with, like, Gundogan and Rodri as your central midfielders, oh, and I guess Fernandinho, I'm sorry, regardless of what people say about Bernardo Silva and Kevin De Bruyne, they are not proper central midfielders. We know they're not. They wouldn't work as central midfielders at any other club. So I just... I don't know. Like, yeah, there's a part of me that just thinks, like, let's either get a full season of Haaland and let's see, like, an unbelievably prolific campaign with a guy who's scoring 40 goals in the Prem or something, or let's have this all come back to bite Man City.
There we
and
go.
And let's have an actual title race, and let's... I don't know. Like, football is just... Oh, there's just so much dirty money, Henry. There's so much dirty money. It's so gross. It makes me feel gross. Like, what?
I like how you were going to go for you want Haaland to score goals, but I convinced you to come to the other end of the spectrum on that one. So that is a weird. My other hope was that Hasenhüttl leaves Southampton and ends this limbo of nothingness, which is Southampton.
Have you got three hopes, Henry?
No. That was it. I had three hopes because I was so torn about which ones I wanted. But yeah, the Hasenhüttl one has really annoyed me. But what's your second hope?
Mine was Gabriel Jesus to join Arsenal. And yeah, this is partially like an Arsenal fan thing. And it does look less likely with Arsenal missing out on top four. But as I said to you before, you know, Arsenal added a bunch of high quality players. I'd say Partey probably chief among them without Champions League football. So they do still have a little bit of pulling power here. And he is going to have fewer chances next season. I mean, Haaland's coming in. They've obviously signed Alvarez. Now, maybe they can do something interesting with Alvarez. Maybe he gets an interesting loan. But unless... The thing is, Haaland can't play in the team except as a striker. Whereas actually, the rest of the attack is pretty versatile. But that means that if Jesus is playing, he's going to be playing wide. Well, if he's playing wide, they might have to move on Mahrez, or they're going to have to drop a Foden or something like that. So there's all these knock-on effects of them signing an out-and-out centre-forward. And partly, okay, obviously I want Arsenal to be good. I think he'd be a great fit for them. He's, you know, a really good facilitator. He's a one-on-one threat. He'd stop teams doubling up as much on Bukayo Saka because they'd actually have other players to worry about. But also it's partially, I just want to see him play a full season. Yeah. Like, this is a guy, he's edged over 2,000 minutes a couple of times for City, twice in 5.5 years. The most starts he's made in a Premier League season is 22. It's not very many. No. And yet he's got 87 goals and assists in 98 starts for Man City. He's averaged 0.8 expected goals and assists per 90 across his time there. This is... undeniably a guy who's super talented, who always contributes when he's in the team, whether it's creatively, whether it's in goal scoring. He's now in his prime, and I just want to see him play all the time. That's what I want. That's another thing that annoys me about kind of City teams like this stockpiling talent, that I think I would have liked to have seen this person play more. Like, stop signing players and then just benching them. It infuriates me. You think... I would like to see some of these people play week in, week out. That is the point of football. And so if Gabby Jesus goes to another side that really fits him, then that's absolutely fine. You know, like if Dortmund could make it happen, that would be wonderful. However, I kind of feel like off the top of my head, Arsenal are the only team who both can afford Jesus have a starting spot ready made for him and for whom he'd be a good tactical fit. If there's another one out there, let us know in the comments. I'm sure there is. But they feel like an obvious landing spot for him. So from that point of view, I think it all kind of lines up here. And would it make my team better? Yeah, that would be great.
No, absolutely. I still think you need a more focal centre forward. I think if you could get him, then yeah, obviously get him. But I still think you need someone... Well, yeah, I mean, you've only got, what, 1.5 strikers because Nketiah is probably leaving this summer. So, I think you have to make a few additions up front. I'd like to see a more sort of set out number nine, but if not, Gabby Jesus, yeah, what a player. I completely agree with you. All right, do you want to hear my first prediction?
Yeah, give me your first prediction.
Newcastle are going to finish seventh.
Seventh,
yes. Now, slightly contradicts a few things you're saying earlier. I think Leicester are in an interesting moment. I think their centre-halves have been pretty poor. Jamie Vardy's not getting any younger, although I still am quite amazed that Jamie Vardy's goal-scoring record is pretty stunning. I think West Ham cannot maintain the same levels that they've been at the last few seasons, considering they've barely changed their starting 11 once. I just think United is going to be in transition. I really think that I've been so impressed with Newcastle. If they can attract the players that they want, Dan Ashworth obviously going there as a director, if he can finally get freed from Brighton, I think they are going to be in a super strong position. If you saw the energy after that United game was pretty impressive. It's not that I want this to happen because I kind of disagree about how they've gone about it, but if they're going to do it this way, white sport washing, then they better do it properly. And I think the early signs are that they are kind of onto something. And if they can sign someone like Lucas Paqueta, if they can make some, eyebrow-raising additions, then they could have a seriously special campaign. And I can't see why they couldn't finish at least seventh next year and qualify for some kind of football, be it Conference League or Europa League.
Yeah, I mean, I'm less impressed by Newcastle. It's hard to say, right, because their numbers were so bad in the beginning of the season that those are obviously bringing down the averages. But their numbers since Howe took over are not spectacular. They're good. They're better. They look like a mid-table team, but that's what they look like. They look like a mid-table team. And they're pressing better as well. But it'll be interesting to see how that goes over the course of a whole season. Like, quite often teams need to adjust. And it's interesting to me, the Eddie Howe thing, because the people who said Eddie Howe was going to be a success at Newcastle, they got kind of lucky, because the way that Newcastle have been good is not a way that Eddie Howe's Bournemouth teams were ever good. Like, yeah. Bournemouth were never a solid pressing side like this that made the centre of the pitch impossible to play through. They never, ever were. In fact, they were incredibly easy to play through. So, it's interesting. Has Eddie Howe genuinely added this string to his bow, and can he sustain it when teams start to adjust? Or might we see teams start to adjust, you know, the more talented managers, like in the mid-table, like say Thomas Frank, and then maybe Newcastle come back down to earth a little bit. Now, obviously, if they can add some more incredible talent like Bruno Guimarães, then that is really going to help them. That might be the X factor here, right? But yeah, I don't know. I'm open-minded about Newcastle. They might be really good, but I will kind of reserve judgment until I see what they do in the summer window. If they get more signings of that caliber, and if they get someone like Paqueta, then yeah, sure, it's quite easy to be optimistic about them. But I do think they're going to need a few more of those to make it happen.
I think respect to Eddie Howe. I apparently did a lot of like thinking, and you know, one of those where they always say they go and visit all the grounds, they go observe other managers, and they come back this kind of new improved individual. And I do believe that maybe he's done that. But yeah, I mean, good luck to Newcastle. What's your prediction? Actually, I'm reading it now and I'm already, I don't like it.
Okay, yeah, my one, let's just get through this quickly. I think Man City might finally win the Champions League.
Snooze.
They've been basically neck and neck with Liverpool as the best side in the world this season. Bit of a freak result against Real Madrid. I think anybody watching could tell you that. They should have been out of sight in the first leg. But the fact that they've gone to a final, the fact they went to the semi, this adds to the experience of that squad. It's going to help the squad overall. Now looks like they're linked with a midfielder, so they finally look to be addressing that. Linked with left back moves, finally look to be addressing that. Adding Haaland, pretty good. Grealish will be in a year. I don't know. And I look at the other big teams and I think a lot of the big teams around Europe are in a pretty bad position right now. Bayern are reaching the end of a cycle. And yeah, they've got some good young players, but they also need to work out what's happening as they lose one of the best strikers that we've ever seen. Chelsea need to rebuild their back line and have not been very impressive this campaign, and will have a bunch of their midfielders winding down contracts. Real Madrid need to turn over their midfield, even if they get in Mbappe. PSG could lose Mbappe. Liverpool are the only team at Man City's level, in my opinion. And so maybe Liverpool win it this year and win it again next year. Like, that's perfectly possible. But I don't know. It feels like one of these days Man City are just going to get it right. And I actually think if they'd just gone out in the second leg at the Bernabeu and instead of just trying to turn it into a boring slugfest, they just said, you know what? We're just going to beat you the way that we beat mid-table teams. Yeah, you know, like, you could see them. They were being cautious, right? They were just trying to make the game, like, dull and passing it around. And if they'd actually just set out to win the way they set out normally to win, I think that their quality would have told. But because they played in this weird way, Real Madrid were able to kind of, like, get back into it, had some energy at the end, and just, like, coasted crowd fervour to win, basically. I don't know. I think if they just won the game in a normal manner, the way they would win a game against Brighton, then it would have been fine. But anyway, I think that's, I don't know, it's a boring prediction, I guess, but also, like, we've never seen it happen before, so yeah, let's see. Yeah, who knows?
You're right, there's not many big teams that can stop them. I hope there's a wild card again. I like the Villarreal wild card this year. I'd like to see
someone else
get through, but I agree with you. It probably might be City, or maybe PSG.
Yeah. Who do you have one more prediction?
All right, yeah, my one more prediction is, it was going to be a hope, but then I was like, no, this is a prediction, and that's Mitrovic is going to score...
Jesus.
13 goals? 13. That's
13?
The number.
That's quite reasonable. I could see that.
Maybe 15. I was 15, 13 ballpark. What's Tony on this year? If Tony could get to around the 15 mark,
yeah, something
I
like that.
Think my man Mitrovic... Because everyone's going, oh, but can he do it in the Premier League? Firstly, he has scored 11 goals in one season for Newcastle when he was a lot younger. Secondly, I don't think... I think this team plays a lot better under Marco Silva. It's more accommodating to him. It really depends on what creative player we get in. Because obviously losing Fabio Cavaglio is a big deal. Harry Wilson, is he Premier League level? Sometimes not. It's hard to say with him. But their link-up is essential. Niskan Skibano, players like him aren't good enough to provide. Mitrovic, if we can get a few decent wingers in, maybe one more creative midfielder, then I genuinely think Mitrovic is going to cause a lot of defences problems next year because he's going to be in so much confidence. What he's achieved this year is outstanding. What, 43 goals? It's nuts. So, obliterating the championship record. I think there's a great striker there. He does it for Serbia. There's no reason why he can't do it for Fulham in the Prem. And we're going to coast, and I say coast with a wire shut, to 15th place in the Premier League.
Wowza. I mean, that's a bolder prediction, to be honest. Like, I have no problem with this because I've always not really understood why Mitrovic hasn't been a regular scorer in the Premier League. But I think what often happens is Fulham have a bad start to the season, have a bit of a panic, people get dropped, Mitrovic often gets dropped, a new manager comes in, everything changes round. If they just have the same manager for the whole season playing Mitrovic up front every game, he will get some goals. He's too big. He's too strong. He's been too good a goal scorer in the championship. And actually, the championship now, the highest standard championship we've ever seen. You know, the players coming out of the championship now are really good. You know, whereas in the past, the championship was kind of full of people who were not good enough for the Premier League anymore. Those guys still exist, but there are fewer of them, and the young players coming through are really exciting. So Mitrovic is not getting tested in the championship. Yeah, I don't know. I can get behind this. I think 13 is actually a surprisingly reasonable number. I thought you were going to be like 18 or something, and that's where we start to get to the under-over. But yeah, why not?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, to be honest, most Premier League strikers don't score more than... They seem to average around 21 this year, so 18 is a bit wild. But yeah, God, 15. I'll raise it to 15 and settle there.
Whoa.
What's your final prediction for this?
I think Conte will probably leave Spurs. I mean, obviously, it depends what happens this summer. but there are already rumours he's offered himself to PSG. PSG apparently choosing between him and Zidane. Zidane doesn't seem particularly keen, otherwise I think this deal would have been done already. Every time that anyone talks to Conte about his job situation, he says, I need to talk to the club at the end of the season. Now, I think that they're going to finish top four and that will push him towards staying, depending on how much money he gets in the summer and the kind of players they're going after. But I don't know. Are they going to compete for the title next season? Like, imagine the players they'd have to sign to compete for the title next season. Like, they would have to be really special. And they'd probably have to keep Kane and Son fit all year. That's what they'd need to compete for the title. I just find that hard to imagine, you know, with the standard of Man City and Liverpool. And Conte, unless they get a really deep run in the Champions League, they could be an interesting wild card, actually, in the Champions League. Unless they get a really deep run in the Champions League, does Conte stick around to manage Spurs in a third place battle against Chelsea? I don't think that's what he wants to do. And that is probably what he's going to find himself doing, barring something absolutely crazy happening. So I don't know. I just kind of think this is not a... It's a really good match for the moment because it makes Spurs serious again. It gets them competitive. It means they might be able to get some guys, like they've got Kulusevski. They can get some guys in who actually, as some of their stars like Lloris and Kane and Son age out, they will have stars waiting to take their place. But it's still unlikely they're going to end up with stars of that level.
I will say, he would have known that challenging for third place was as good as it was going to get when he took over after Nuno. I don't think he's under this idea that he's suddenly going to be, Spurs can't challenge for anything. He's already done way better than anyone assumed he would in a short period of time, getting them into the Champions League spots. I don't think he's any illusion they're going to be closing the gap next year. If he's just got a bit of patience and stays there. I mean, if they sign De Vrij from Inter Milan as a centre-half this year, if they get a few other additions like that, which I don't think are going to break the bank, he'll probably go for that kind of 28 to 30-year-old bracket, which I know we're not huge fans of, but I think that's probably where he's going to be fishing around. I think they're a few additions away from being a real problem to every team they face in the Premier League. Because one thing you could say about Spurs is no one blows them away, ever. No one just beat, you know, it's always a 1-2, 2-0 kind of victory game. They are a fairly consistent team in the way they line up. So yeah, I'm not so sure. I think at least one more season at the helm of Spurs before he really decides. But I don't think there's a load of great offers out there for him right now. True. Unless Ancelotti leaves Real Madrid soon, yeah, and he goes there because he knows he's at least got, you know, one team he has to beat every year. At the moment, I think maybe even Atletico Madrid, that might appeal to him more. But at the moment, I think he's happy cashing that paycheck which Spurs are giving to him and at least proving his credentials. It's not hurting him what he's doing at Spurs at the moment. I think he's only made them better.
But he doesn't seem very happy about it. And he himself has said, you know, competing for top four is not something I'm used to. Like, I think that he took the job because he is like a football fanatic and wants to coach all the time. And I think Spurs is actually a surprisingly good job for him, despite the fact that he's acted like he hates it the entire time. Yeah. I do think they can be a problem for every team they face. I do think they can be the third best team in the country. But you can be an 85-point team and you're still not going to win the title over Liverpool and City. It's just not going to happen. If it were one team at that level, then you'd say, yeah, maybe they have like a bad season and we can pit them for the title. But with two, I don't know. We all talk about him winning the league with Chelsea in 2016-17, and that was great, but a bunch of teams had a bad season that year. And I don't think that that's going to happen again. And I think that the Spurs squad is worse than that Chelsea squad was. So I guess that's my issue. I do think that if he stayed there long term, then he could build a great side. And I think Spurs are in a really good position to do that. But the question is whether he's got the patience to do it. And, you know, you've just seen Klopp sign a new long-term contract. Guardiola might do so as well. Ten Hag's coming in at Man United. It doesn't look like Tuchel's going anywhere at Chelsea. I just think that this is the hardest league to win that we've probably ever seen. And I think that he's going to get bored of not competing.
Well, isn't Klopp approaching his 7-year cycle where it all goes wrong at the helm? So
yeah,
just watch this space.
Well, I mean, look, if it weren't for the fact that he was managing Spurs, I'd be rooting for chaos here. You know, everyone would love to see something completely wild happen in the Premier League, but there's wild when like one team fucks up, and there's wild when like you basically need kind of 6 or 7 things to go wrong for your opponents for you to win. And that's, I think, the position Spurs will be in, no matter how good they are under Conte.
All right. I'm willing to be swayed towards your prediction on this.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. You know, maybe he stays and proves us all wrong in this whole, like, you know, you're talking about Klopp's 7-year cycle. Conte has like a 2.5-year cycle, man. he's going to be bored as And yeah, I think the Real Madrid job potentially becomes available. I think PSG could still happen. There are things out there that could happen, but yeah, we'll find out, won't we? So those are our predictions and our hopes for next year. Let us know yours in the comments below. Thank you very much, Henry, for joining me today. Do you have anything you'd like to plug before we say goodbye?
Oh, I'm sure we have some top tens out there to devour. I'm sure.
Yep.
I'm trying to think. I did a good thing on Postecoglou at Celtic and how he's changed that around. I quite like Postecoglou. Seems like a cool guy.
Yeah, cool. Thanks very much for joining me today, Henry. Thank you to you guys at home for listening or watching. Make sure that you're subscribed to Football Daily Podcast on YouTube, or you're subscribed to the Extra Time Podcast using whichever your favourite podcast app happens to be. And hopefully we'll catch you next time if we produce another one of these.
Who knows?
See you later. Bye.